High School students for our afternoon oral argument, and they are from East High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming this afternoon. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. It's called Court with Class. Students from all the high schools in the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if the invitation is accepted, the students will come to an oral argument. They will have received the briefs in this case, and for those of you who are not students, there are synopses of this case available in the foyer. I think if you haven't read about the case, you will enjoy the oral argument more if you do have a brief summary available to you. And then if they come before lunch, they get to meet with a justice. Did you come for lunch? No. Well, you didn't, so you'll have to take us en masse, all of us together, and watch us in action. But those who come in the morning meet with the justice, and the justice discusses the processes that the court uses in deciding the case, but does not discuss the substance of the case. So we've met you. I'd like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we will now hear our third case for today, 03-2487FT, Benjamin Atkins versus Swim West Family Fitness Center. John Riley will argue on behalf of Benjamin Atkins. Mr. Riley.
May it please the justices of this honorable court. My name is John Michael Riley, and I represent Benjamin Atkins in this matter. As the court will have noted from the briefs, the parties take two fundamentally different approaches in this case. Our approach is to urge the court to continue path that has followed for almost 30 years, a path which gives primacy to public policy but weighs various considerations in determining whether or not these exculpatory clauses should be upheld. The defense, by contrast, is advocating for a change, of course, and essentially what the defense advocates is that we give primacy to freedom of contract and that the analysis be limited largely to that subject to certain narrow exceptions, which effectively would make this a problem of drafting. So that as long as we had a release that was reasonably clearly drafted, they would argue it ought to be enforced. Let's talk about where we are now and where the approaches that are advocated would take us. First of all, this state has always seen fit to give primacy to the public policy that advocates for the safety of the public and for the rights to recover of those who are injured through the negligence of others. And that's reflected in the fact that our public policy clearly disfavors these agreements and subjects them to strict scrutiny. And there's no dispute about that. The scales have clearly been tipped by this court over a number of years to support the public interest. It does not disregard the right to contract, but it does give primacy to public policy and the public interest. And that's reflected in the cases. We have a uniform rejection by this court of exculpatory contracts going back for about 30 years. We have a body of law.
How do you square the policy argument that you're making with the recreational immunity statute?
I'm glad you asked it, Your Honor, because I think that there is an important comparison here. The recreational immunity statute, 895.52, does confer blanket immunity. That's the purpose of that statute under certain circumstances. Those circumstances are not met here, which is why that defense was not pled. But what I think is particularly interesting is that in the amicus brief, they cited 895.525. That is a statute which does discuss assumption of risk by people who participate in certain activities. But importantly, what that statute says is that is not a bar, unlike 895.52. What it does is it makes assumption of risk something that can and should be considered by the courts, but it couches it in terms of contributory negligence. So what you have is what I think is something very consistent with what this Court has done, which is to weigh the interests of the parties rather than to confer blanket immunity on one party.
Mr. Riley, what do you think it would take to make an exculpatory clause valid and appropriate and enforceable by the courts?
Justice Crooks, I think that the Court of Appeals has spoken to that in a couple of cases, but in my mind there are several factors. First of all, I would argue that, the nature of the risk and the need for the agreement is important in terms of public policy. And I think that's so because, one, the public interest at large is not implicated most of the time when we're talking about high-risk activities. It's a small, select group of people that elect to participate in those activities. In the cases that the Court of Appeals has upheld exculpatory contracts in, they have uniformly been people who are very experienced, well aware of the risks, and knowingly chose to encounter those risks after signing an agreement whose significance they were well aware of.
So you think we have to have a high-risk activity to begin with?
I don't think it's the only concern, Justice. I think that a high-risk activity is important. I would not say that I can say blanketly would rule out any other situation. But, yes, I think that is important for the reasons that I've stated. And I think that the case law as we see it would suggest that our courts have also found that important, certainly in the courts of appeals. And, of course, I'm not suggesting that high risk is enough to validate the use or that that is sufficient in itself to make an exculpatory agreement enforceable, because clearly there are cases such as Arnold where you had a high-risk activity, or Dobratz with the water skiing case and the motor racing case. And in those cases, it was not sufficient given some of the other problems with the exculpatory clause. But I do think it's an important first step and a very important consideration.
What else do you think it would take?
I think beyond that, Judge, I think what you need is you need something that is laid out, as the courts have said, clearly and unmistakably. I think you have to be able to say with certainty, looking at that form, that somebody who looks at that form would know precisely what rights they were surrendering. I also think it's important that the release not be so broad that it would simply accomplish the release of any claim for any purpose. And I think all of those things have been looked to. I think that the contemplation of the parties, which is something that the defense has stressed, is not unimportant, but I do not think that is the sole test or the most important test. I think the breadth is key. I think the other thing that I believe is absolutely key is the opportunity to bargain.
Now, counsel, on that observation, who would the person bargain with? Who would they bargain with? Would they hear the woman, the physician, came in, unlike the Yager case, I think I was hearing Richards and some of the others where there was some question about the language and where it was and whether it was in bold type. When I read this, this is the only real language on that exculpatory, let's say the hold harmless clause that was signed. In other words, everything asks her about how she, her name, address, reason for visit, and this she was a guest, and then it goes into, I agree to assume all liability for myself without regard to fault. Now, that's what you're saying is too broad, right? They'd have to say, what would you want in there?
I think it's overly broad and ambiguous, Justice, but if I might turn to Richards very quickly, because I think that's an important point as well. The form in Richards actually, in many ways, I think, is comparable to the form here. The form in Richards also serves two purposes. The language of the release occupies the bulk of that form, and, in fact, it's the very first thing. It's at page 1013 in the Richards case, and that language, that particular document, starts with the release language. It has two paragraphs of release language that are, frankly, much clearer and more specific than the release language here. And then it has some information. It's called a guest authorization. A passenger authorization, excuse me, this form is called a guest registration. I do not think there are significant distinctions between those two forms. And that form was found wanting, obviously, in Richards.
Counselor, I want to ask you a couple of things, and if you can't answer me, just say it's not in the record. I have some curiosity about how this woman managed to drown, given what is in the record. And I have two questions for you. First of all, was there a postmortem examination, an autopsy, to show that she actually did die by drowning, or at least was a contributing factor? I know she died the next day. And secondly,
Is there anything in the record that would show any special circumstances that might have contributed to this, like did she have a seizure disorder, did she have a heart attack? Is there anything like that in the record?
There's nothing in the record, Your Honor. I think there may be. I mean, obviously, if this case goes forward, we will develop that information, and there is information, but it isn't part of this record to my knowledge.
Thank you.
Justice Wilcox, I apologize. I don't think I got to – I started – I got off on a bit of a tangent, and I don't think –
You were talking about the Richards, that the language is similar in this case as in Richards. And I said, no, say Yauber, for example. Here the only language I was saying that was on this so-called release was right on the face. It was what I was saying, that the only other language they asked her name, address, city, reason for visit, did you hear of Swim Fest, and would I like a membership? And then the rest is entitled waiver release statement. And this somewhat goes to Justice Crooks's question, is what does it take to make these valid if there is anything?
And I believe there are things. One, as I said, I honestly believe if you look at the Richards form, Justice, you'll see that it really is fairly comparable. I mean, the same thing is true of the Richards form, but the only other thing that's on there is some personal information, and there's a statement that says they give her permission to ride in the truck. But most of that form really is release language, and that's language that starts from the very top of the form rather than being at the bottom of the form as it is here. In terms of what it would take, I mean, I think clearly what you need beyond this, first of all, I think the language can be set apart and can be made clear. I think referring to something as a waiver release statement raises a couple of questions. One, it doesn't really tell you what it is, certainly not a layperson. And two, it certainly does not suggest some opportunity to bargain. And three, it really doesn't even implicate contract particularly, because it doesn't say waiver release agreement or waiver release contract. It just says statement. In terms of the language of the first sentence, you know, I would respectfully submit that that language is as broad as conceivable. It says, I agree to assume all liability for myself without regard to fault while at Swim West Family Fitness Center. I mean, that language, first of all, focuses on the individual signing, not on anyone else. One of the things that has been criticized by this Court is not only the failure to reference negligence specifically, which clearly this agreement does, but also the failure to make some kind of very specific reference to the fact that you are releasing claims based upon the negligence or at least the conduct of the persons who are seeking to be released. And this language does not specifically speak to their conduct, nor does it mention negligence at any point. There is some discussion in the defense brief that somehow this language only releases negligent conduct, and they argue that because they say that fault is synonymous with negligence. Fault is, first of all, I think, an amorphous concept. I think that word in itself is ambiguous. We cited language in our brief which makes it very clear that fault is not synonymous with negligence. It's a much broader concept that certainly could be extended to intentional acts as well. That language, by its terms, would release not just the employees but anyone, and it would release them really for any purpose, for any harm that was caused, for any reason. And that's overly broad.
Counsel, as I looked at this form in this case, rightly or wrongly, this is the way that I saw it. I looked at that first sentence that you're referring to now, which you read, and I will reread. I agree to assume all liability for myself without regard to fault while at Swim Fest Family Fitness Center. I saw that first paragraph as focusing on the I, and that the second sentence, rather, first sentence focusing on the I, the second sentence focusing on Swim Fest. The first sentence, I agree to assume all liability for myself without regard to fault. I said to myself, well, whose fault? My fault, Swim Fest's fault? You know, it's one of those almost like misplaced modifiers, you know. So I saw the problem with the first sentence as one of a little ambiguity. But in my mind, it is the second sentence that is the real focus of this case, not the first sentence. Am I correct or incorrect in saying it's the second sentence? I might be wrong.
Well, I think the problem, Justice, is that, of course, anyone reading this, and they're lay people, not justices or even lawyers, doesn't have that benefit. They're going to read it all together. So I think the first sentence and the confusion it causes is significant. But secondly, I think that the second sentence says, I further agree to hold harmless Swim West Fitness Center or any of its employees for any conditions or injury that may result to myself. Again, that's lacking entirely in any reference to negligence. It's lacking entirely in any reference to some conduct on the part of those people. It's just saying I'm holding them harmless for anything that happens to me. And, of course, the other problem with that sentence is it's overbreadth. I mean, on that language of that sentence, it says that they're holding them harmless for any condition or injury that may result. That would implicate whether it was intentional conduct based on that language, intentional conduct, negligent conduct, safe place law. There is nothing that can survive that language if the court interprets that language to be binding.
Does the first sentence, let's say I'm at SwimFest and I am injured, and it's not at all SwimFest's fault. They're not implicated at all. Someone comes up, clearly Bill is the guy's name, and he injures me. Nothing to do with SwimFest. How does this first sentence read? I agree to assume all liability for myself without regard to fault. Now, that would be Bill's fault, while at SwimFest Family Fitness Center. Can that first sentence be read to assume responsibility for injury, even if it's a third party's fault? How do you read that?
I think
that?
It clearly can be read that way, Justice, and frankly likely would, because the second sentence goes on to say, I further agree. So it sounds as if that's some sort of additional requirement. And the first sentence says, I agree to assume all liability for myself without regard to fault. It doesn't say whose fault. And that's, as I said, that's a very broad concept, and I think that language could certainly be read to apply to anyone's negligence or anyone's fault or anyone's intentional conduct, and for that matter. The language here, honestly, is as global as anything. I do not believe there's any comparable language in any case that has been upheld. You can look at, and I know the trial court cited to Merton, but what the trial court cites from Merton is, frankly, a very small piece of the release in Merton. There's two more paragraphs that are much lengthier, more precise, and more detailed than the language the trial court cited. And I don't believe anyone else has cited language that's comparably global that's been upheld by this court, or for that matter, by any of the courts of appeals.
Well, let's just for a moment assume there is no release. Okay? There is no release. For a moment. You're going to sue on what? Negligence?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the negligence is what?
Negligence is the failure to use that degree of care that's normally exercised under the same or similar circumstances.
And what is that care here? That's very good.
That's a
you got an A. A plus. Very good. What is that?
I can get justice.
And who made you? And I'm here to help you, counsel.
I know the no love and serve part too, Justice.
Okay, good. So you've got a duty of reasonable care. And what is reasonable care in any circumstance differs, right? If you're driving a car, it may be speed, lookout, blah, blah. What's the standard of care here?
I think the standard of care here is going to be determined at least in part on expert testimony about what's appropriate and what should have been done. I mean, the allegation here is that the owner who was serving as a lifeguard absented herself from the pool, period, and that's the failure.
There was water in the pool and it wasn't contaminated as far as we know. So the negligence here, that is the standard of care, was they promised a lifeguard and the lifeguard was not there.
The lifeguard was to be on duty, and the lifeguard left their post.
Okay, that's correct. So that's negligent of not having a lifeguard, potentially, not having a lifeguard. Then the question is going to be, was the lack of a lifeguard a causal factor, right?
That's correct, okay. Justice.
All right.
And, you know, I think that's one of the things that's very important, is that on the one hand, what's being contended for here is really blanket immunity, regardless of the facts, that no matter what has happened, at least they would argue it's limited to negligence. I would say the language does not so limit it. But even if we assume negligence, they're saying regardless of the negligence or the degree of negligence, they get blanket immunity when this is enforced. Our position is not that there ought to be blanket liability. Our position is that there ought to be a weighing and there ought to be an opportunity to weigh those things, to weigh the conduct of the parties. You know, certainly the conduct of the decedent is relevant in this case. And if there are arguments to be made about that, those arguments can be made. But what happens if we uphold these exculpatory clauses is there is no argument. There is no weighing. We just have one determination, and that ends all inquiries.
Counselor, does it matter that what happened here is just the kind of accident one might expect to happen at a swimming pool and its worst of all consequences? You talk about overbreath, but all those other things haven't happened.
Right.
One thing has happened. Does that matter?
I think it does matter, and I think that that's the contemplation of the parties issue, and I think it is an important issue. I view it very differently than the other side does. First of all, I think that to suggest that somebody walking in to swim laps at a 4-foot deep lap pool is automatically going to be, you know, convinced that they have a risk of drowning, frankly, I think that's far-fetched. I don't think most people would even contemplate or think of that risk at all. I don't believe it would cross their minds. It is not comparable to somebody jumping in a race car and running around a track who certainly does contemplate that you may well crash or that may happen. I think it's also important, if you look at the cases that have talked about that, specifically if you looked at Arnold motor racing case and you looked at the Dobratz case, the water ski case, what they focused on in those cases was not simply the risk that somebody would be injured, because nobody disputed that both of those people who were an experienced driver and water skier respectively knew they might be injured. They focused very narrowly and specifically on the manner in which they were injured, and that was a major problem in both those cases. The court said, we don't believe that the specific manner in which they were injured was within their contemplation. I would argue that the specific manner in which he was injured was not drowning. That's like saying that the driver in Arnold was injured when he crashed, or that the water skier was injured when the following boat ran over him. Certainly risks that, in my mind, would have been much more present in their mind than the likely risk of drowning would have been in Carlos Wilson's mind. But if we look at the real cause here, the real cause is the failure of the lifeguard to perform a duty and the failure of the lifeguard to be where the lifeguard belonged. And there is no evidence in my mind here at all that would permit us to conclude that that was within the contemplation, certainly of Carlos Wilson at the time she executed this document.
Thank you.
If I can turn briefly to a couple of other points. I think that my concern here really is very fundamental, and that is that we have a weighing test that we've adopted. We have a test that I think has served the state well and has served the citizens of this state well. There is no question that that test has led uniformly at this court and widely to these exculpatory clauses being struck down. There's some dispute here as to, you know, who's requesting a change in the law. I think if you look at the body of law and certainly the body of this court's decisions, there's no question that the real request for change comes from the defense. There's a suggestion in the amicus brief that somehow we're going to open the floodgates, and, you know, the floodgates are always being opened. I'm reminded there was a wonderful comment, I think it was by Gunter Grass, who said the black knight of fascism was always falling in Europe and landing in America and landing in Europe. It's just something that we hear every time. First of all, the Arnold court said specifically, we're not going to make decisions based on threatened consequences. But most of all, there is not an iota of evidence that would support the notion that this is somehow going to produce a flood tide of litigation. In fact, the law we're talking about has been the law of this state for 30 years. There has been no flood tide. There is no evidence that insurance is unavailable. There is no evidence that insurance is unduly expensive. What we would do is we would shift the risk from insurance, which is what we do to spread risk in this society, to individuals who are injured who have no ability to spread that risk at all. And I think that in itself is very significant. The legislature didn't see fit to do that when they enacted 895.525, as they could have. If they really are concerned about this and believe there's some problem, I would suggest respectfully that's the place to address it. There is no reason to upset the balance of where we are, to convert from a rule that says that these agreements are going to be unenforceable in most instances to a rule that says they are going to be enforceable in almost all instances, subject only to drafting requirements. And that's what the defense requests here. If we look at what's happened over the past 30 years, clearly the trend has been not to enforce. If we enforce this particular agreement, which in all fairness, has virtually all of the flaws that our courts have commented on in striking these down. If we enforce this on this language under these circumstances, what is it that would not be enforced? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Sarah A. Zylstra, representing SwimFest Family Fitness Center et al. Ms. Zylstra.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Zylstra, and I represent SwimWest Family Fitness Center and West Bend Mutual Insurance Company. We're here today because the Court of Appeals has certified this case to you. Rather than spending time on what's already in the briefs, which I believe has addressed the issues well, I'd like to talk to you about the Court of Appeals certification, what I see as what they're asking you, and also spend a few minutes talking to you about a couple of points in Mr. Riley's reply brief. The Court of Appeals certification, in my opinion, raises two issues for the Court, one of which I think the Court of Appeals knows, but it's looking for a little nod of an agreement from this Court. The first point is whether public policy or a contractual analysis is the right way to go with these exculpatory contracts. And I think that Yager, which is the seminal case here, answers that question. In Yager, the Court notes that Dobratz and Arnold resolved this issue contractually, whereas Richard did public policy-wise. And Yager says that, let's be clear, the germane analysis is public policy. Court of Appeals states that in the certification, but they state it in such a way that I think they want this Court to say yes or no to that.
Counsel, I excuse me for interrupting, but I want to just clarify. I, too, saw that as part of this certification of the Court of Appeals, and I was a bit surprised because as I read their certification, they talked about the trilogy, that is, Richards and Arnold and Dobratz, and said, you know, well, contract and public policy, what is it? But I didn't see them cite Yager, and I had read Yager, and I said, so what's the question? There's the answer. Now, am I missing something?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's possible that in reading Yager, I actually believe that Yager was an attempt by this Court to take all the cases before it and kind of to articulate the test. And I think that it did it well. And I'm not real certain why the Court of Appeals didn't see Yager the way I did or potentially the way you did.
And that's really my underlying basis of my question. I didn't articulate it as I should. And that is, am I reading Yager correctly? That's the way I interpret it. That it answered the question.
The cynic in me says that perhaps the Court of Appeals wasn't certain it liked the result that Yager was going to produce in this case and therefore certified the case. However, I promise not to be cynical and just address. But I do think the Court is looking for a nod, a reaffirmment from this Court that public policy is the germane analysis from this Court. Yager, the reason why I think Yager is so seminal is I think it took all the cases before it and articulated a two-part test for exculpatory contracts. The first question that you look at is whether the agreement clearly, unambiguously, and unmistakably explains to the signer that she is accepting the risk of the other party's negligence. And the second question is whether the form, looked at its entirety, alerts the signer to the nature and the significance of the document being signed. The public policy part of the Court of Appeals question was easy. The second part of what the Court of Appeals certified, to me, is whether within the contemplation of the party's factor that's appeared in multiple cases is still pertinent to a public policy analysis. That is what I would like to spend my time addressing. And I think
except Yager says that that the contract is void against public policy for two reasons. And then it looks to the contract.
You are correct, Your Honor, that there are two reasons in Yager.
And they are all tied to contract, the two reasons of contract, and they are just then put into a cover sheet of public policy.
The public policy analysis has to look at the contract and will involve some examination of the contract. However, it's somewhat semantic whether we call it a contractual factor or a public policy factor, but ultimately we are deciding that a contract that was that was entered into by two parties is not going to be enforced for certain reasons. That's why, to me, it's a public policy analysis. They may use contractual terms here and there. Some can argue that within the contemplation of the parties is really intent of the parties, which is a contractual analysis. At the end of the game, though, it's a public policy analysis, and I think the question the Court of Appeals is asking you is whether within the contemplation of the parties is pertinent, is a factor to be considered under public policy grounds. To me, the answer is clearly yes, and I'll explain why. The first, quickly to get rid of the second question in Yager, which is whether the form looked at its entirety alerts the signer to the nature and significance of the document being signed. In all the cases that we've looked at, they look at factors, whether it's a single-purpose document, whether it's a multi-purpose document, whether the headings are proper, whether it's conspicuous. All of those are looking at answering the basic question, did the person know it was a release? Did they know what it was that they were signing? In this case, this is it. It can't get more conspicuous than this. It's a bright red 5.5 by 5.5 card, and the release is front and center. There is no way that Dr. Wilson did not know that this was a release, and if we had any doubt, the person at the counter handed it to her and told her what it was. Dr. Wilson clearly satisfies that factor. She knew it was a release that she was signing.
Counsel, one of the fun things about the law is that you can make arguments depending on the premise that you shape. If you shape the premise as it has to be clear, and here it's clear that it was a release, bingo, because you can see the language. If you shape the premise or the focus, as Yager did, or at least it seems to me that it did, and I'm looking at page 78, the introductory paragraph of the opinion, we conclude that the exculpatory contract signed by Yager is void as against public policy for two reasons. Number one, it failed to clearly, unambiguously, and unmistakably explain to him that he was accepting the risk of Hidden Valley's negligence. And as the opinion then continues on with regard to that, towards the end of the opinion, as it's summarizing and cleaning up, it says at page 84, nowhere in the form does the word negligence appear. Indeed, the form fails to exhibit any language expressly indicating Michael Yager's intent to release Hidden Valley from its own negligence. So I say to you, you may be absolutely correct that it's clear that it's a release. But as I read Yager both at the beginning and at the end, it says not that it's a release, but that it has to be clearly and expressly indicate in intent to release Hidden Valley from its own negligence. And Yager says here, nowhere in the form does the word negligence appear. So depending on what you focus on, can shape your results and your answer. Can you respond
to that? Absolutely. But Yager, there were two factors. That's one, and I'm about to address it now. The first factor that I addressed was the second part of Yager, which was, did she know it was a release? Was it conspicuous? So the first part is looking, was it conspicuous? Did she know it was a release? The second part of Yager is, did she know what she was releasing? That's the second part of the test. And that is, to me, where within the contemplation of the parties factor will appear. And let me explain why. Sometimes signers are able to tell us what they knew and what they didn't know. And an example of that in the case law is Keller. There was a volunteer in that case. They took her deposition, and she says, you know what? They asked her what she thought she was signing. And she said, well, I thought I was saying I wouldn't sue him for an injury. Lo and behold, someone who admits they know what they're signing in terms of a release. That doesn't always happen, though. Sometimes people don't admit to what it is that they knew when they signed a document, or sometimes, like in this unfortunate case, we don't have the ability to ask Dr. Wilson what she understood when she signed it. In those kind of cases, the court looks to other factors to determine whether the signer knew what they were signing. Did they know what they were releasing? We do that by several factors that appeared in the case law. One is the opportunity to read the release, ask questions, and bargain. Why is that important? Because if you really read the release and you have an opportunity to ask questions, if you don't know what it is that you're signing and you don't know the significance of the document, that's your chance. That's where you ask questions. And if you don't ask questions, we're going to at least presume, if you're not around to tell us otherwise, that you potentially understood the words as most people would understand them. That's part of the test. The second test is within the contemplation of the parties. If we look at this language and we have something that clearly falls within it, we're going to assume that the most normal people, when they read this language and they see what happens, they're going to think, yes, this is where this type of language would apply. That's why the factor is relevant. It's relevant in this case. The third is we look at the language of the release and we determine what the language of the release would convey to the signer. Those are the type of factors that we determine, that we look to determine the second part of the Yager test. Did she know what she was releasing? So, and I think with respect to the contemplation of the parties, which is what the Court of Appeals struggled with, if the risk is outside the contemplation of the parties, the answer is no. The signer didn't know what they were releasing. If the risk is within the contemplation of the parties, and if there was a meaningful opportunity to read and ask questions about that release, then we're going to say that, yes, the second factor of Yager was met. The signer knew what she was releasing.
Counsel, if I can refer you to pages 25 and 26 of Mr. Riley's brief.
Brief in chief or reply?
Brief in chief. He refers to the cases dealing with the opportunity to engage in a meaningful process of bargaining. You talked about the parties' contemplation and what they understood. What exactly can be bargained with this type of release? As I understand it, this is a place where people swim. I'm assuming that if the person fails to sign this document, they will not be permitted to swim. Is that correct?
Well, you know, Your Honor, you're asking a question of which I don't know the answer to, in the sense that I'm not certain what would have happened if Charisse Wilson said, I don't want to sign this. The owner of the facility was at the facility, and Karen Kittleson, my belief is the person at the desk, would have asked her to come to the front, and she would have talked to Dr. Wilson, and potentially she would have either said, okay, I'll let you swim without it, or she would have said, no, this is really something that's important to us. We don't know because that didn't happen. But the first and foremost opportunity to bargain is the opportunity to walk away. Dr. Wilson did not have to swim at this facility. She could have gone somewhere else. There are potentially other facilities that don't require this type of exculpatory contract or that have different provisions. They may charge more money. She chose this facility. She chose to sign this release. She had the opportunity to read it and ask questions. She was told what it was. She took a long time to fill out the form. She conversed with the attendant on other matters, but didn't talk to her about the release. She was specifically asked when she came in if she needed help in the pool.
Counsel, you're making these arguments with regard to contemplation of the parties. What is your bottom line? What is it that was contemplated?
Well, my bottom line is hopefully we win, but
the penalty.
But what was within
to the last?
What was within the contemplation of the parties? I think 99% of the people, when asked about this release and told that a woman went into the pool and drowned, would say drowning is within the contemplation of the
okay,
parties.
That's what I thought your answer was going to be.
Drowning.
Drowning. And then I look again back at Yager. And now I'm reading from page 82, and the Yager court was discussing Arnold, and it said, page 82, looking at the Arnold contract, although this contract specifically referred to the defendant's negligence, we don't have that in the contract that's before the court today, but the Arnold court specifically referred to negligence. The court concluded, I'm reading from Yager, the court concluded that while injuries from negligent track maintenance may have been waived, a negligent rescue operation was not within the contemplation of the parties when they executed the agreement, and therefore the contract was unenforceable. Using that by way of analogy, let's say, for argument purposes, that negligence, just like in Arnold, was in this contract, and that it would be said, could be said.
By the way, Your Honor, I believe it is, but go ahead.
Okay. And it could be said that the negligence as a result of drowning was being addressed, just like in Arnold, the negligent injuries from negligent track maintenance. But can it be said that it is in within the contemplation of the parties that although a lifeguard was to be on duty, the lifeguard was temporarily absent, was in the contemplation of the parties?
Your Honor, I mean, just to provide a little factual context, of course, we dispute that the lifeguard wasn't in the area, of course. And to answer a question posed that relates somewhat to this, while it is the record has not been developed, it is the defense's position that Dr. Wilson suffered from what's called a dry drowning, which is a misnomer. That is, she had no water in her lungs. We do not believe she drowned. We believe she died instantaneously in the pool. That has not been developed in the record because it's irrelevant to the motion. The motion
is it in the record at all?
I don't recall the status of the record at the circuit court. Okay, so we haven't been there for a few years.
If it's not in the record, then we would disregard it.
No, you wouldn't. Right. It was more of a, I'm sure it was asked, the question was asked by way of curiosity, and of course, so we have dispute as to that. Now, with respect to do we expect that a lifeguard might inadvertently look away or step away such during, at the exact moment I'm drowning. Is that something within the contemplation of the parties? Anyone who has been at a public beach or a public pool has to answer that question, yes. How many times do we hear of these tragic stories of kids that go under just at the exact moment that the lifeguard's attention is diverted? That's, to be fair, that's why people drowned. It's because that because the lifeguards aren't always there or aren't able to quickly pick up who it is that's under the water and get them out and perform CPR in a satisfactory manner. It's an unfortunate fact of life, but certainly it is within the realm of possibility when you enter into a swimming pool. Now, did Dr. Wilson contemplate that, in my example, you know, that she was going to have a heart attack? No, but she's got to contemplate that a risk of swimming is drowning. It was Justice Callow in, I believe, the Merton decision. He has a dissent that says, you know, at some point with sports-related and leisure activities, you've got to assume the ordinary risks that go along with those activities. This is a sporting-relating incident that is clearly, I think, within the realm.
Counselor, are you telling us that we can decide as a matter of law, regardless of the state of the record, that drowning would have been within her contemplation when she signed this?
I think you have to.
Why?
And the reason is because, unfortunately, Dr. Wilson isn't here to tell us otherwise. The only way that we...
There may be facts that could be developed from Dr. Wilson, whether she's here or whether she's not here, that might tell us something different about what's within the contemplation of the parties.
Perhaps, but the summary judgment is aptly named and oftentimes used by the federal courts, the put-up or shut-up motion of a time of summary judgment.
Yeah.
I properly move for summary judgment if there is evidence out there to suggest that Dr. Wilson didn't, this wasn't within the contemplation of her. It was Mr. Riley's opportunity then to present it, and he hasn't done so. The facts as they are as developed as they're going to be. And I think one of the things that with respect to within the contemplation of parties that I think it is both a subjective and objective factor. And I think that's something to think about with respect to this court. Mr. Riley complains that I have referenced her as a physician. Well, clearly, if Dr. Wilson, let's say, had some sort of mental impairment that she couldn't understand what it was that she was signing, then maybe this is not within the contemplation of the parties when they signed the agreement. The reverse has got to also be true. If we're going to look at mental impairment, we've got to also look at mental ability. And clearly, as a physician, she's got the mental ability to read and understand a contract, which she spent a long time reviewing and a long time signing.
Counsel, if I can follow up Justice Rogensack's question. I guess I'm concerned if you say that we have to find the drowning was contemplated by the parties as a matter of law in this case. I just think of the instances when I take my children and my grandchildren to a pool area where there are lifeguards on duty. I'm not contemplating whether I sign anything or not that drowning is an end result when there are lifeguards present. So I guess I view things a little bit differently if you're in an area where there are no lifeguards present. When you talk about this as a matter of law under the facts of this case, aren't you really asking a bit much here?
No, Your Honor. The as a matter of law, the facts are what the facts are. There's no more fact to get to. We've been through this many times, and we're here now telling you that these are all the facts there are that go to this analysis. That's why I say that the court has to. If you send it back down to get further developed, I don't know what Mr. Riley and I are going to do. There's nothing further to develop in this case. With respect to your grandchildren, I certainly don't mean any disrespect in that. What I mean is that when you take your kids to a swimming pool, I think everyone has to understand that there is a risk of drowning. It's a sad and unfortunate thing, but it's a risk. It's a risk when you leave your children in a bathtub and you step away to answer the phone. We know this. Why? Because it happens, and we hear about it, and we understand that water and people don't always mix. It's a risk, and we do things to try and buffer that risk. But certainly it's a risk that we must appreciate.
This is a fitness center?
It's a Swim West. It calls itself a fitness center. It's mainly swimming.
But are there other activities?
They're minor in scope. And to be honest, I don't have a full list of the regimen of activities of the facility. It's not the Princeton Club, as you may envision it.
Suppose there was exercise machines of different kinds. Do we assume here that this exculpatory clause covers all of the activities at that fitness center?
The activities for which you enter a facility, you assume the ordinary risks associated with that facility, in my opinion. So, for example, if I go to the Princeton Club and I'm there to lift weights, and while lifting weights I get injured from lifting weights, I would think that that would be within the possibility of risk that I accepted by using the facility.
Suppose you met someone at the club and said, why don't we play tennis after we swim? You didn't intend that when you came in, but is that clause going to cover anything that might happen in a tennis match?
Is the tennis court in the facility, or are we going outside the facility? If it's in the facilities, I think it's still within your contemplation that you're going to the facility to use the facility. While you may go to use one part, you recognize that there are other parts of the facility there, and that if and when you choose to use them, that you are accepting the risk of the facility. I think the release covers that.
Where do you get this? You're accepting the risk of the facility. I don't see that. Where are you getting that premise of law?
With respect to the release or with respect, or I'm not sure I understood the question.
Okay. I guess the threshold question is that you started addressing is whether or not contemplation of the parties is even a relevant part of the analysis for public policy. And that's, we have circumvented that threshold question and gone on to discussion of
what is within the contemplation of the parties. I guess we've jumped over that threshold question. But it seemed to me in your response to the question, you said, well, it seems you cited yourself. Well, I do that all the time. Yeah. It seems to me that when you go into a facility, you assume the risks of the facility. And, well, that sounds good, but I'm just so used to saying, where does that say it in writing? Isn't the contract? Where is our precedent that says that? And so that's what I'm – that's my question.
The question comes from the release itself, which is that I agree to assume all liability while – for myself while at Swim West, and I agree to hold harmless Swim West Fitness Center or any of its employees for the conditions of – or injury. I think those two sentences together say that you agree to accept the risks of using the facilities.
See, I don't know that. I don't know this word. Take my hypothetical of Bill. Bill is a
yes.
Dastardly devil. And he comes and he starts hitting me.
Right.
I mean, awful. Okay. I agree to assume all liability for myself without regard to fault.
Right.
While at Swim West Family Fitness Center. I can argue that that means I'm liable even though Bill hit me.
That, first of all, the release uses the term fault. It is my position, and it has been my position, that fault is synonymous with negligence. It does not bar intentional conduct. That's first. Second of all, let's take your hypothetical and let's ask the question, who you sue. If you sue Bill for this, Bill's not a party to this contract. I don't think he gets the benefit of an exculpatory contract at all, and I would not so hold. I don't think he can use this to bar your suit. However, let's say you sue Bill and you claim that it was negligent by Bill. He was flailing his arms in an effort to tell me a story and he knocks me out. If you sue Swim West for that negligent conduct and you claim that Swim West should have had a policy written on the board in the swimming area that said no one is allowed to flail their arms, this bars it.
Your answer said, well, Bill is not a party to this contract, and therefore the exculpatory statement doesn't apply. Well, how do you mesh that response with the very beginning of your oral argument where you said contract theory and contract analysis isn't the analysis for exculpatory contracts, relying on Yeager, public policy is the only germane analysis?
If you recall, and I addressed this with Justice Abrahamson, what I said is it's not irrelevant. It's that the court has decided that it would look at it in terms of public policy. Contractual analysis and images come through there all the time. When we're looking at whether it speaks to a single purpose, multi-purpose, we really are looking at the contract, and we will inevitably hit contract principles when we do so. But the analysis is public policy. I see that I'm running out of time, and I feel like I must make one important point, and I hope you will give me one moment to do that. Mr. Riley has presented this case as me or my clients claiming a change in the law. I say this. Mr. Riley is here asking you to overrule Richards. He's not doing it overtly or outwardly, but that's the effect of his argument here, is to overrule Richards. Why? Because Richards said broadness is not enough to destroy a release. It requires other factors, and that's where Yager comes in. But the only thing that the Court of Appeals said with respect to their certification in this case is arguably this release is broad. Well, I put to you, Justices, show me one judge who doesn't think that every release is broad. Every release by its nature is somewhat broad. All the releases that you've ever looked at will always use the terms like, you're looking to release any and all claims involving, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, down the line. Why? Because the facility can't know what necessarily is going to happen. And they're trying to the extent possible to convey to the person who's signing it the circumstances under which this release will apply. If you decide that an overly broad release does not hold water, and that's it. That's the only reason why this release is arguably faulty. It's the only thing that the Court of Appeals says. What you are saying, no release will survive. None.
Well,
that's...
Go ahead.
My last point is we create the impression to businesses that they can control risk when in reality they can't. And it comes back to the old adage, our release is really strict in theory but fatal in fact.
I think that's a good adage.
Do I think it's a good adage? I do not. I think that what that does is create a misimpression. People are out there trying to follow the law. They believe that they can protect themselves with these contracts. And
oh, they hope they can protect with the contracts.
Counsel, let me ask you this. You mentioned that you saw fault as being synonymous with negligence. I note that you cite Black's Law Dictionary on page 19 of your brief.
Yes.
But part of that definition includes bad faith or mismanagement.
True.
So that seems to include more than just negligence.
However, if you look at Yager, one of the points that Yager makes in footnote 2 of Yager is that to the extent possible, we should try not to use legal jargon with people who are signing releases. People, and the question is someone on the street more likely going to understand the term negligence or understand the term fault?
But when somebody says it's your fault, that could mean that you didn't do something that I think you should have. It could mean that you did something wrong you shouldn't have. It just seems to contemplate more than just simple negligence.
I ask you, though, to give me a better word for the term negligence than fault. Arguably, could we put the term negligence in, but does the signer, part of what the Yager analysis, did the signer know what they were releasing? Did they know what they were signing? Many people, ask most people in this room, Mr. Riley correctly defined negligence, but I bet you there aren't many people in this room who could, but they'll understand fault.
Well, but Billy hits me. That's not negligence. And what do I say? If you want the common jargon, if you want the vernacular, I say, and Mom says, you can't stop it. And I say, Mom, it's Billy's fault. Right?
I say that a lot of people, that would happen in a lot of circumstances. I will say this, though. We're not here trying to enforce a release involving intentional conduct. There's no claim of intent here whatsoever. The release is clearly being applied in an appropriate manner, and the courts can police that. And I see I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer additional questions if need be.
I ask one question from the uninformed. When we talk about these exculpatory releases, is there a different set of principles at play, for example, at a parking lot, a paid parking lot, when there's something on the ticket that says we're not responsible for thefts from the car or damage to the car or something like that?
Yes, because in that case, and if I'm understanding, like a sign, for example, that says we're not responsible for accidents in the parking lot or for lost items or whatnot, in those cases, first of all, you haven't read the release. You haven't had an opportunity.
Suppose it's on your ticket.
You still likely haven't read, and by ticket, do you mean on your grocery slip?
I put in $5, I get a number for my car, and it says right on the little ticket.
At that point, to me, you haven't read the release, you haven't had an opportunity to ask questions about it, and you haven't had the opportunity to decide whether or not to undertake the contract. You have already given your car to whoever it is you're giving it, and they're giving it to you. And I think that goes to the two-question Yager. Did you know what it was you were releasing? You didn't know because you didn't have a meaningful opportunity to read and ask questions. So it couldn't have been within the contemplation. You couldn't have understood the release because the release was given to you after the fact.
So you're saying all those releases are worthless?
I do. Yes, I do believe that is true. Hmm. But that's not the case here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Riley, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice. First of all, let me respond to what Justice Prosser just said. I mean, what counsel said in response to that was what the whole test is whether you read it or not. So that then apparently what she would say is if as long as you read it, that would be it and you would be bound to the release. That's not the test that our courts have propounded, and that really isn't correct. I mean, what the test really is, do you have an opportunity to bargain? Actually, the case law says it has to be the product of a process of bargaining that has integrity. But certainly, at least you have to have an opportunity to bargain. There is no evidence before this court of an opportunity to bargain.
Counsel, tell me what I've been here long enough and sat on enough of these cases to know what opportunity to bargain do you have when you come into any of these situations, whether it's a Ski Hill or it's Richards or it's this case. I mean, basically, maybe in Richards you could have, because, but here the bargain was either you sign this or you don't swim. Isn't that the bargain?
But it certainly seems that way from what was proposed, although counsel suggested maybe there was something more there. You know, I'm concerned because we're hearing lots of talk about what might have happened, what she might have understood, and frankly, all of that is fact-dependent. I disagree with counsel that we can't have more of a record. Of course we can. If the case goes to trial, as we believe it should, you've got a much richer record. And then if that's really, if many of these issues are fact issues, as I frankly believe they are, then that's the appropriate way to deal with them. But frankly, I don't think we need to get there.
Counselor, what's in the record about in the contemplation of the parties that would make it a fact question?
Well, what's in the record, I guess it's probably the absence of what's in the record, Justice. I don't think there's anything in the record specifically. I think that all we know is that she was given this and told that she had to sign it, which really goes to opportunity to bargain, not the contemplation. I mean, as I said, what we know is that this is a 4-foot-deep lap pool that was supposed to have a lifeguard on duty. The notion that we can conclude or should conclude as a matter of law that she must have contemplated, one, drowning, but two, beyond that, because what we would be required to meet the test from Arnold and from Dobratz, the ski case, would be that she contemplated the specific manner, which is the absence of the lifeguard. And I disagree with counsel's notion that when you walk into a swimming pool with a lifeguard on duty, with or without your children, you would anticipate that lifeguard would simply absent herself from the pool. And frankly, it is not in the record, which shows it's not a matter of turning her head or moving for a minute. It was far more than that. And it was sufficient to cause this drowning. And I think those are significant issues, and I don't think they warrant enforcing this agreement on this case or suggest that this particular risk was within the contemplation of the parties. Justice, I'll respond. You asked about, Justice Bradley asked about negligence, and they said, well, we could put negligence in. Well, if you put negligence in, then you're complying with what the court has said you should do. So then you're not subject to criticism. And to suggest, well, somehow we'd be criticized if we did that, no, you wouldn't, because the courts have said repeatedly, if you put in negligence rather than the vague and general and ambiguous language they use, that would be okay. Finally, real quickly, I'm sorry, Justice, I just want to make one point quickly. To suggest that people are relying on these releases, given the status of case law in this state, is simply inaccurate. Any good lawyer looking at these releases generally would tell their client they would likely not be enforced. Any good lawyer looking at this release, given the breadth of that release, the ambiguity of that release, would tell a client you can't rely on that. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
How do we know from the record that there had to be, I think it was, had to be a lifeguard there?
Yeah, I think that really goes to negligence, Justice, and is really part of the fact issue in the case. But I actually believe that there is, in the depositions in this record, I believe there are questions that were asked, and I believe there are responses that would say, yes, a lifeguard was to have been on duty. That's, again, we haven't focused on that in a while, but I believe that is, in fact, in the record. Yeah, I know it to be the case. I believe strongly it's in the record. Let me turn real briefly, if I can, just to the notion it's contemplation. We spent a lot of time on that. In fact, their brief really focuses on that, and so did their discussion. That is one factor, and I don't believe that factor is met either, but there are a number of others, including breadth, including the opportunity to bargain. We cannot simply focus on contemplation of the parties. And finally, if I might, the notion that we're requesting that Richards be overruled is silly, quite honestly, and I don't mean to be demeaning in any way, but it just is not supported at all. This release suffers from all of the same infirmities that Richards suffered from. If you look at that, Richards criticized the fact that it was overly broad. Richards criticized the fact that it served two purposes. Richards criticized the fact that it was on a preprinted form which did not allow an opportunity for bargaining. Richards criticized all of those things, and all of those things are present here. To reach the conclusion that the defense would have you reach here would, in my mind, not just implicitly, but would require that you explicitly overrule Richards. All they've done is to suggest, sorry, I've run out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Morelli. Thank you, Ms. Silstra, for your arguments in yet another release case. That concludes the arguments on 03-2487-FT, Atkins v. Swim West Family Fitness Center. And thank you to the East High School students for coming this afternoon. We are in recess. The court will meet again in the conference room at 3:00.